You're listening to listener-supported WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM. We're online at WPKN.org. I'm really thrilled to be joined by Frank Gallo, who is going to be talking about his new book, which is called Birding in Connecticut. Hi, Frank. How are you? Oh, there you are.
How are you?
There you are. I had the wrong switch up here.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now. Yes, thank you.
Terrific.
Frank is a local birder, and I found out when I was talking to you yesterday that you are also a longtime WPKN listener, which I guess means that it is true that WPKN listeners are bird brains.
Yes. Yeah, you cross the spectrum.
Yes. And, you know, I just played that song about bird songs, and you had an earlier book about bird songs, correct?
Yeah, I have a kid's book out called Bird Calls and another called Night Sounds. I was going to say they were done, I think they're out of print now, but that was back in, they came out in 2001 and they were around until about 2011. You can still get them used online, I think.
I heard a robin today. That was the first time I've heard a robin this season. It was delightful.
Yeah, they were going over my house last night in pretty good numbers heading north, so... They're here. They're around in the winter as well, but the migrants are coming back.
So you live here in southern Connecticut. You have been birding for a long time. I first met you, I first heard about you because I belong to a bird list that's here in Connecticut, and you're on there frequently, and I've seen you on eBird and various places, and I heard about this book. So it was really, really great to have a chance to speak with you. Why don't you talk about your history with birding?
Okay. It goes way back. I started getting into my first memory is actually of a bird. I was maybe three or four, and I remember seeing a blue jay and a robin in my neighbor's yard. And when I was about the same age, my grandmother's cat, Gus, dropped a red-headed woodpecker at my feet, and... I can still feel what it feels like, and I think that had a particularly profound effect on me. So all through my childhood, my grandmother and my mom fed birds early on when it first became a thing and had bird books. And so I was thumbing through Chandler Robbins's book on birds of North America, and I have many of the pages memorized in my head from childhood. So I was already into it well before I became anything close to an adult. That I have ended up going to Southern Connecticut State University to be a marine biologist, and then I met Noble Proctor, Dr. Noble Proctor, who plucked me out from marine biology and steered me towards doing birds.
Interesting, and birds are your profession.
I work for Sunrise Birding. Gina Nichols runs this wonderful tour company out of Brantford, and she has tours all over the world, and I do my share of them. I just came back from leading a terrific trip to Jamaica with Ricardo Miller and Andrew Hall, and that was a really good tour. We got all 29 of the endemics, and I'm heading off to Cuba with a small group next month. And then I'll be going to Spain next year, so I try and get them in as many as I can in a year.
What a wonderful life! That's really great.
It's an interesting life. I'm pretty pleased. I do a lot of writing, and I still am doing. I used to run the Coastal Center for Connecticut Audubon in Milford, and I still do. I still keep my finger in environmental ed, so I'm working for a freelance for Ed Advance out of Litchfield, and we do environmental stuff around the state, so I do that as well as doing the bird tours, and I do a lot of local tours in Connecticut for Sunrise Birding, so I'll be doing come April, late March, I'll be going to different places in the state for short trips to places like Western Pennsylvania for Henslow Sparrow in May and things like and elk and things like that, so it's a nice diversity.
I also grew up in a family that looked at birds a lot. In fact, we had a bird. In fact, we still do. My mother's house has a bird feeder just outside the dining room window, and in full view of the dining room window. And we would always have several bird books that were, you know, piled on the table, and we're always looking at things. And although I describe myself to you as I like knowing about the birds that are around me and figuring out what they are and what they're doing, although I'm not I'm not someone who goes out looking to add more birds to my list, but you know, certainly I appreciate people who do that and try to travel around the world and find things and look at things I've never looked at before. So
I was going to say that, you know, that's kind of why I wrote Birding in Connecticut. Noble Proctor, originally my professor, wrote 25 birding hotspots way back in the 70s, and that went out of print, and Falcon Press was looking for someone to update it, and they found me. And then the economy crashed, and I got my book back, and that was actually probably the best thing that ever happened, because then Wesleyan University Press found me, and Birding Connecticut, I was able to write a much bigger book. This has got 142 sites in it and 48 chapters. So, and it's on color, and it's got full color maps and 50 pictures, 50 photographs and things. But it's a way to get people out and looking at birds, and you don't have to be an expert to do that.
And it's very, very, I was describing it earlier, and I said there's something you hear a lot in weather forecasts now that it's hyperlocal. And this bird book is hyperlocal, too. And I was looking through some of the areas around where I live, such as East Rock Park in New Haven, and you have such detailed descriptions. You say, okay, well, the sun will first hit the archery field, so that's a good place to start. So you really even if people aren't going, you know, aren't on a bird trip, they've got someone literally taking them by the hand and saying, start here, go here, go here, go here.
Yeah, and you know, I've used these books, obviously. I do a lot of birding in a lot of different places, and many other places I go to, the first time I go there, I don't know much about it if I'm scouting for a tour, and I use these books all the time, and many of them are really good, but there's a lot of them that they get you to the place, and they leave you there. they're good luck, we got you there, good, here's the birds you might see, but, you know, you're on your own. And they'll show you a map, but you don't really have a sense of how to approach any given site. So in this, I tried to give people a fighting chance, you know, and I also kind of went through and looked at things that people are always asking me on tours, like, where's the bathroom? So I included the bathroom. I included where the parking lot is. I included where to park and whether there are, you know, fees for that, and practical things that people can utilize. So that it makes it a little less scary when you're going to a place you've never been to before.
So you're talking about different hotspots, and you do have hotspots throughout the state. What are say the top five spots in the state if you really want to see a lot of birds?
If you look at the book, it's got 48 chapters, and they're distributed around the state. I broke the state up into sort of six regions, north, central, and coastal, and they're divided. But if you look, it's heavily skewed for the coast, and there's two reasons for that. It's because more people live along the coast, especially the western coast, and because the way the migration works in Connecticut is birds are funneled down rivers and that run north-south and ridge lines that run north-south, and eventually they hit Long Island Sound, and they then turn and go along the coast. Some birds go straight across, but many of them prefer not to cross over water, especially larger expanses, so they'll turn and go along the coast. So basically the coastline is getting birds funneled into it. So the biggest lists for parks are all along the coast, and the highest list is Hammonasset Beach State Park, which is in, last I checked, I did the list of a few years back, was 335-ish, somewhere in there. And then Milford Point is a close second. It's in the same range in the 330s. And then you work down the coast a little farther, and you get places like Sherwood Island State Park in Westport, and Cove Island Park in Stamford, and probably Greenwich Point or Todd's Point in Greenwich. Those five are certainly right up there, and they're sort of central, and then west. But Lighthouse Point in New Haven, and there's a new park in the book in Branford called Ecology Park, which is a capped landfill. Those two parks are terrific sites in the fall. And they've near, well, Lighthouse Point's been around a long time. It's the second best coastal hawk site next to Cape May, New Jersey, in the Northeast, for non-Budios, non-soaring hawks, like exhibitors, like Sharpshin and Coopers and things like that, and ospreys. But that park has a list of nearly 300 species, and most of the birds that have been recorded there are from just the fall. So it's a pretty wonderful site as well. And Ecology Park is a new thing, but it's going to rival Lighthouse if enough people get over there and start looking.
I did an interview with some scientists, I think from Cornell, a few months ago, and they had written that article, an op-ed piece in the New York Times about the nighttime migration of birds, which I found just totally fascinating. That's when a lot of species and large numbers to the point that they can actually be seen on radar are migrating.
Yeah. Birders are we get pretty obsessive when it's migration time, and I used to do there's competitive events called the World Series of Birding out of New Jersey that's Pete Dunn's brainchild, and they raised money for conservation. We raised money for conservation, so there were teams that were sponsored, and we would go down and spend a week scouting, and then you get sponsorships per bird that you find, and the idea is to break 200, and if you can, the top teams were breaking 220, 225, even 230 in a day. So you have 24 hours, and then each bird you get money. So some of the people who are doing it, they'd raise over $250,000 a year for conservation causes. And it was very competitive, and the top teams were running around. We'd do over 600 miles in a day. And every bird was timed to the minute. That's a bit obsessive. And there are things that John Himmelman from New Haven Bird Club invented the big sit, which is we sit down at, I started it with him. It was his idea, but the New Haven Bird Club sponsored it, and then Birdwatchers Digest. And you sit at a place like Milford Point from 4:30 in the morning till 7:30, and you sit within a 17-foot circle, and you try and count as many birds as you can. Again, the idea was to raise money for conservation. And those are competitive events, and they're a lot of fun, and they, raise thousands of dollars for conservation, and that's great. But most people are not going to do that. They're not going to time their route to a minute or stand for, 15 hours or whatever in a circle and look at birds. And you don't need to. I mean, most people want to look at birds out their window, or they want to learn the places close to them, and that's what the book's about. There's stuff in here for any level. There's a lot of information. The appendices, in particular, were designed for anybody to use, but there's information like I compiled for the first time all the rare records of birds since 1965. So that's never been compiled before. So basically it gives you the species, how many records there are since 65, what months they occur, the first date they occurred, and the last date they occurred. So you can sort of infer patterns. So, look at this. This bird's occurred five times, and it's been about 5 years between each occurrence, and the last one was 4 years ago, so maybe I should start looking for one.
I'm speaking with Frank Gallo, who is a birder, and his recent book is called Birding in Connecticut. It's a compendium of sites throughout the state and how you can find the best, have the best birding experience in each of these sites. And as I was talking to you yesterday, I said I have the digital version of this, which is actually quite good because it allows you to link. So if you go to Hammonasset, for instance, there's a link there, so you can then go and look at the bird observations from that site. And this is all done on ebird.org, which is really become sort of a center for birding. Why don't you talk about eBird and sort of how that works in everything?
When I set the book up, I wanted to do something a little different. I didn't want just – I love books, and I wanted something you could put on, you know, on the seat of your car and look at with good color maps, which this has, and with information that you could get, like the seasonal ratings and the habitat you're going to see, and the what birds are there, specialty birds and other key birds and migrants and things like that. But I wanted to add, if I could, some technology to it. So I put in QR codes in the physical copy, and there are links in the digital copy. And if you scan the QR code, it takes you to the eBird checklist for that park, which they're dynamic QR codes, so they update with the eBird update. So if you go, for instance, to Bluff Point out in Groton, and you are doing eBird, and you pick the hotspot that is Bluff Point, and you enter your birds, when you submit that list, because you pick the hotspot and not a personal site, it will add your data to the main site's list. So that list gets better and better over time. And when I did a regional list, like I did a chapter on Stratford, or coastal Stratford, I put all of the sites within one list. So if you click on that, it takes you to the list for the region, but at the top of the page are each of the individual sites. So you get an overview bar checklist, which gives you seasonal occurrences. It's a bar graph. And then if you click at the top, it gives you each individual site. So you action for it. So if they decide to put a school there or a ball field, they can, and that park will disappear. But if you go to all these parks and you start to compile this data, we did Mondo Ponds, for instance, in Milford, and in 5 years we got 180 species recorded there. And so when the Conservation Commission looks at that list, they can say, look, there's 25 species here that are, of concern. And we have this other park that doesn't have nearly the diversity. If you want to put a ball field, put it over there rather than over here. So they can essentially make informed decisions. So eBird gets the data, which is great because they're doing big picture conservation stuff. Conservation commissions can use the data, and at the same time, people are contributing to that data, and then they get the use of the lists out of the book. So everybody wins.
And eBird is developed by Cornell, which has I guess one of the top birding research in the country, and then they also has another app that goes along with it called Merlin, which I love, which you can basically take photos of bird. You can take a photo with your phone of a bird, and you put it into Merlin, and sometimes it will tell you the correct bird. Sometimes it will not tell you the correct bird. It depends on the how good your photo is, but that's a fun tool to use.
Yeah, and they're constantly developing more and more tools. I mean, eBird's a wonderful resource, and you can even get, you can buy a subscription to Birds of North America, which gives you really detailed information about any species that occurs in North America. And you can buy a subscription to that through Cornell as well. It's a gigantic resource, and it's useful for the general public, but it's also being used by researchers and scientists. And the more people who use it, the better the data gets, and the more.
I've been meeting some new birds recently in my life, which I think has sort of heightened my interest in all things birds. I'm spending time on the Quinnipiac River, and one of them was the bufflehead. I love the buffleheads. I described it to someone. I said they look like Oreos, as they're these black and white birds with really big heads.
And my friend's daughter, when she was young, John Himmelman's daughter, actually used to call them water chickadees, which I always thought was the best name ever. Uh-huh. They really are water chickadees.
Yeah, they're sort of small compared to a lot of the shorebirds. Red-breasted mergansers also. I'm seeing a lot of those. And they've just started their mating dance, which is, at first I thought, what are they doing? Because they do this funny thing where they pop their head up. They look almost like giraffes. That's high as it'll go, and they duck their heads up and down. And it was so interesting to see them because they weren't, usually when you see those birds, the only thing they're doing is diving and eating, and now they were just sort of hanging out. It was like a Saturday night for the birds. They were just hanging out in this little group and doing this funny little dance. So that was a lot of fun.
Well, this is a great time for waterfowl watching, because most of the waterfowl pair bond in the winter, so they're going through their courtship now, and they often have some pretty bizarre courtships. It's not designed to show you birds. There are tips and tricks and lots of useful information if you actually read the text that will help you identify books, but it's not its main purpose. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that was awesome. But what would be your favorite? Like, if you were going to do a tour, like, for one day, what would be your favorite one out of the book?
If I was going to... Well, at this time of year, I'd pick the Norfolk sort of winter finch trip, or one of the duck geese tours. I really like, you don't get up that way very often. For people who are interested in, say, eagles, then the eagle tour this time of year is fantastic. This is a great time of year to go along the Connecticut River to look at eagles. You can even do River Quest does tours out of Essex, and you can get on a boat with an old friend, Bill Yule, and Mark and Mindy, and they will take you down the river. And if the river's frozen, the birds move south with the ice line, and you can see, 40, 50, 60, 100 eagles, depending how frozen the river is.
Wow.
So that would be that's a really good one for this time of year. Thank you.
Thank you for calling.
Okay, bye.
Bye. It's interesting that we were talking about the sort of touching on. I mean, the birding is a sport. It's an aesthetic activity, but we were also talking a lot about just the environmental impacts of the birding and the idea of the canary in the coal mine. As birds go, shows how our environment is going.
Yeah, Peterson talks about this. Roger Torrey Peterson, who lived in Old Lyme, talked about that. They studying things like ospreys and DDT back in the 70s. The bioaccumulation of pesticides was discovered, and work was done to stop using that pesticide. Sadly, the pesticide is still used in other countries. We produce it and send it abroad, to fight malaria and things, but it still bioaccumulates and has a pretty detrimental effect on wildlife. But in the United States, ospreys and peregrine falcons and eagles, bald eagles, have recovered, and it's taken years. The first eagle nest was in the 80s, as I recall, in Connecticut. They nested here traditionally, but were wiped out by DDT. It thinned the eggs. They came back in the early 80s, and for many, many, many years, Don Hopkins was one of the people who discovered that first nest. And it took years for them to recover. And now, in about the last 5 to 7 years, they've slowly, gradually built up to about 25 nests. And then in the last 5 to 7 years or so, that doubled. So we're in the 50 range now of nesting eagles in the state, and we're starting to see eagles nesting along the coast in places like Milford and even New Haven. There are a couple of nests in New Haven, Guilford, Brantford, and up the major rivers now, all the way up, through Hartford. So they're slowly recovering. But it's good that people pay attention to birds and keep an eye on this. And they're big insect eaters, and with the new articles have been coming out talking about the incredible die-off of insects worldwide. That's sobering, if nothing else.
And actually the eagles that does nest in New Haven, I first joined there's an email list that you can join that's birders discussing what they're seeing. That I joined just because I wanted to see what was going on with the eagles, because I knew that there were some near where I lived. In fact, one of my amazing bird experiences was a few years ago, driving down Skiff Street towards State Street in North Haven and seeing the eagles were doing their mating. I don't know what you call it. They were like grabbing onto each other and spinning around. And it was just happening right there, coming down Skiff Street. the eagles are just sort of right here and amongst all the people and everything, and sort of doing their thing. But I love the email list too, because I can be sitting at work and I'm hearing about people who are out traipsing through swamps and looking for things and finding things, and it's a lot of fun.
Roy Harvey was the compiler, and he's retiring, and we're looking replacing Roy. You know, my hat is off to him. The amount of work that he's put in over the years, compiling and supervising and the COA Rare Bird Alert is just a monumental achievement. He's an amazing person. He's finally going to retire from doing it so he can actually go out birding again. Poor Roy. But that service is provided for free, but it isn't free like anything else. So right, if you're into birds, people don't even realize that COA sponsors that. But like I said, you know, if you've got an extra 10 or 15 bucks, join COA, you get the Connecticut Warbler, which is a great quarterly journal that's produced. Plus, you get to go to the meetings, and there's all these workshops and things. So I highly recommend it. And you can still go online and use the Rare Bird Alert, and everybody does. But yeah, it's such a great thing. And to see an eagle in New Haven, I mean, it actually, like Lighthouse Point is a great example of what birding does for people. It there's this camaraderie of the hawk watchers. They're dedicated. Many of them just want to look at hawks or eagles, and they meet every day. Some of them are there at dawn, and they're there all day long until the migration stops and for the day, which is often, you know, early afternoon. Things like falcons will fly late in the day as well. So, but there's usually a lull from say 1 or 2 until about 4. And these people come and they meet one another, and friendships are forged, and people who would never have ever met in any other way, who may not have any other thing in common, find common ground together watching birds sitting at a hawk watch. And I've always liked that.
Frank Gallo, I will say you're pretty amazing too, and this book is so detailed. It must have taken so long to compile this and write it. The book being Birding in Connecticut, I'm sure that a lot of this knowledge are things that you've built up over the years, but it's just the detail in this is sort of mind staggering.
Well, thank you. It's a really kind of an interesting thing. The first round was a 4-year project, and I wrote it in 3-month chunks over 4 years. Then I got it back, and there was sort of a 4-year lull, and then I got it back. Then I Wensley and found me, and thank you all my editors, and Wesleyan's fantastic. Susanna Tamarin is just incredible. But anyway, from the day I got the contract, I think it was in 2015, it was April 10th, to the day I got my first copy was exactly 4 years to the day. April 10th, 2018, I got the first copy of the book. So it was, and that I rewrote the first 4 years, I pretty much redid it. A good friend of mine did the structural edit for it. So it's a 500-page book. It won an award. Well, it was won a grant. I can't say that it was an award, but it's in the Driftless Connecticut series. So it got, it says, if I can find it, this book is a 2018 selection in the Driftless Connecticut series for an outstanding book in any field on a Connecticut topic or written by a Connecticut author. So I was pretty thrilled to see that. And what that did was underwrite the cost of the book. And what that did was produce a really nice, this book is on really nice paper. It has full color maps. I designed it so that it has two indexes. It has an index for the sites, and it has an index for the birds. And the things in bold, if it's the site index, it takes you to the start of the chapter. If it's in bold on the species index, it takes you to an annotated species account. So I've got all the birds in one of the appendices. Is an annotated species account that tells you a little bit about each bird. There's an appendix on birds by habitat, so you know if you're going to a place, a habitat you've never been to, it gives you a little background about what you might see. There's an appendix with bar graphs. I took my friend Greg Kanasek did the original bar graphs, which are a seasonal occurrence over time. A species list that gives you seasonal occurrence. So you know not to look for, blue grosbeak in the middle of the summer in Connecticut in general is a bad idea. And if you look at the habitat stuff, you'll probably figure out very quickly that you probably shouldn't look for a woodpecker in a pond. There are these appendices give you a lot of background information, and the bar graphs that Greg did, I updated, so they're current up to 2017. So this is the most current list of Connecticut birds that's available in a book with a bar graph that tells you when to look, and it also includes when the nesting season is, so you know, things like that in the graph. So, and you have a quick reference in the back. There's a map with the sites located, so you know where they are, and a quick table of contents. And then in the beginning of the book, there's a full table of contents, and the book's completely color-coded. So each region within the book of the six regions has a different color. There's a bar of color across the front of the book, so that you can the front of the book, so you can see it quickly turn to a region, and then the front table of contents gives you each region with the sub sites within each region. So there, you know, chapter 7 is Westport, but chapter 7 has 9 sites in it. As the caller Vanessa asked, you know, that's a great spot that gives you, if you want to just go to that region, it's going to give you, you've got multiple sites within a central, there's a central site, and then there are multiple sites near it. So if you want to spend a whole morning or a whole afternoon or, you know, a full day, you can do that, and it's easy to figure out how to do that.
And you were talking about having just come back from Jamaica and getting ready to go to Cuba. How many birds do you have on your life list of the things that you've seen all over the world?
I honestly don't know.
Wow.
I know approximately what my U.S. list is, which is in the 17s somewhere. But I don't, and I know what my Connecticut list is, but I don't really know my world list. I have them all. I have all of the lists, but I've never compiled them. I'm guessing I'm somewhere between 2,500 and 3,500, something like that. I could be completely off by an order of magnitude, as far as I know. But that's. But I've never compiled them. They're sitting on my shelf, and someday, you know, some winter, I will pull them off and start sticking them in eBird. But right now, I can't tell you the answer to that question.
Well, I noticed on eBird that you're number 2, I guess. I don't know if it's Connecticut or maybe it was in the New Haven region. And I thought, you must, you know, do you think, okay, well, I'm going to go, you know, I'm going to go find this bird and then I'll be number 1 again. But you're obviously not one of those crazy, I need to be on the top and number 1 sort of people.
No, I mean, I'm not going to balk if I get to the top, but no, I mean, we have a friendly competition. The top 4 or 5 people, it's a matter of if you live long enough. Noble Proctor's at the top, and he, you know, birded for 60 something years in Connecticut, so I think his list is something like 403 or 405. And then the next folks down, Pat Dugan and Frank Matlick and I and Mark Santier are all in the 390s in some form or other. Last I checked, Patrick, I think, is now number 2. He hasn't put his list up, but I think he's actually at 399. I'm at 395 or 6. Frank Matlick's at 396, and I don't know where Mark is. But we've been going back and forth for years. And, you know, 1 year one of us is ahead, 1 year the next year the other is. And really it's just a matter of birding long enough. And we always go and chase new things if we can, if, you know, time allows. I used to be obsessive about it. I've grown more to the side of you get into it because I always got into it because I appreciated the aesthetics of birds and I still do. And I'm now back to that. I mean, I love the sport of it as well, but it's more about the getting out and spending time in nature and the beauty and the interesting idiosyncrasies that birds have and trying to figure out why they do what they do and where they do it. It's become more fascinating to me, not just to collect the whole set sort of thing. I could do that with stamps.
Well, and you have made it a mission to help other people too. So that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah. And it comes around, you know, they've all helped me. And I mean, this book was written essentially by in many ways by a village. You know, you can't. I gleaned tons of information. I know I've been to all of these sites, but and some of them I know down to, you know, walk up to this tree and look, and you'll probably see X, Y, or a Z. But a lot of these sites, you know, I drove around with friends of mine who live in the region and bird those sites every day, and I took a lot of notes. And then between that and what I could glean from the literature and what I could glean from COA's Rare Bird Alert and eBird and all kinds of sources, my own notes, I compiled all that and put it in the book. But you know, I definitely had help from many, many birders. And not all of them were the hardcore birders. There were many birders who just know their patch really well and who took me around and were gracious enough to do so. And I couldn't have done this book without all the birders in Connecticut. And we're really lucky. As a birding community, Connecticut has a really generous birding community. They're wonderful at just giving of themselves. There's all the competition, as far as I can tell, is friendly competition. There isn't this, I'm going to hide a bird because I want to be one above somebody else. That just doesn't happen here, and it does happen in other places, so we're pretty fortunate.
When I spoke with you yesterday, you were just, I think, coming back from a meeting with a group where you evaluate people's rare bird sightings and decide if they can be accepted or not. I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, that's part of the COA too. It's a committee of the COA, Connecticut Ornithological Association, called the Avian Records Committee of Connecticut. And what we do is we meet once a year, and we adjudicate records for the previous year. So we meet in March, and we look over the records for 2000. We just met on Sunday, and there's usually it's about a dozen people from around the state. And our function is to when there's a rare bird that occurs and there's a list that COA produces of rare birds, and I just rewrote the state list and it's out being edited right now. That'll go back up because we just added birds to the list, 40 birds. Our job is not to determine whether or not an individual saw what they saw. I mean, if you said you saw something and that's what you saw, great. Our job is to determine whether you were able to document it well enough that it'll stand up to the scrutiny of time. You know, if 100 years from now somebody picks up this report and reads it, they're going to come to the same conclusion that we did. We're not trying to decide whether you did or didn't see it. And people need to understand we're not. If we reject a record, isn't because we didn't believe you or not. It's usually because, for whatever reason, it wasn't documented well enough to be put into the official record. We keep the record. It goes into the file, and records do come back out again. There are records that have been rejected. I personally have had records that have been rejected that new information was brought up years later, and it can always be resubmitted and reassessed. I had a jackdaw record, the first state record. My brother and I found it at the West Haven dump in 1988, and it got rejected because of origin. Now, at the time, people were suspect as to where this bird could come from. You know, was it a captive bird that was released? And then subsequent to that, new information showed up out of the blue, you know, 30 years later, and the record was reevaluated and eventually accepted. So because it's not accepted the first time doesn't mean it can't be accepted in the future. And there are things that we reject because there is no trend for something, and then later on suddenly a trend occurs, and that happened. Connecticut has the first accepted record for barnacle goose, the first accepted record for pink-footed goose, and the first accepted record for gray-lag goose in the lower 48. And since then, those all have occurred again in the lower 48, with, I think, the exception of gray-lag, which has occurred in the Maritimes, but not in the lower 48. So we meet, we adjudicate the records, the report is done, it goes online in COA, and we explain the reasoning behind whether we accepted or rejected any given record. And that happens once a year.
You're listening to Listener Supported WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM. I'm Valerie Richardson. I'm speaking with Frank Gallo, and I've got to let you go. I could talk all afternoon. The author of Birding in Connecticut. What was that wonderful pink bird that had everyone all excited last summer? That was a tropical bird.
Okay, yeah, it was a roseate spoonbill, and it was accepted. So we added little egret from Europe. We added roseate spoonbill. We added black-bellied whistling duck. And we added black-backed oriole, which was a first U.S. record found in Pennsylvania now 2 years ago. It showed up in Massachusetts. It was a male, and then again it showed up in Connecticut. So it showed up in three places. It was accepted by the American Birding Association and by Pennsylvania and us, but not by Massachusetts as far as I know. But so the Connecticut state list is at 444 now, 444 species.
I hope that spoonbill made it back someplace warm before the winter came.
Well, it was heading that way. Last I heard, it was going that direction. So it's not at all unusual for things like herons and ibis and spoonbills to overshoot. They often have this sort of post-breeding dispersal. It was a young bird. And if the winds are right, they push them up north. They hang around up here for a while, and then they go down. And there's, you know, all kinds of possibilities for why. Maybe it's how they scout and find new territory over time. But it happens. And herons and egrets are really good at getting places distantly. Little egrets came from Europe. Reef heron has come to the States. Cattle egret came from Africa, made it to the Caribbean. This is many, many years ago. And then radiated out from the Caribbean, and now it's found throughout much of South America, Central America, and a good portion of North America. And that bird made it to the Caribbean on its own from Africa.
Wow.
So these birds have amazing abilities to get places. Some birds are flying, you know, 17,000 miles one way in migration. You know, there are birds that put on, you know, 60,000, let's see, 12, 20... 36, 40,000 miles a year. Arctic terns go from the Arctic to the Antarctic, fly around down there all winter, and then fly back. Try that sometime.
Well, you can never get bored looking at birds and thinking about birds. So I thank you so much. Thank you for this book. I really look forward to spending more time with it. I'm hoping to retire in a few years, and then I'm going to spend a lot more time looking at birds.
People want to find it. It's at the Audubon Shop in Madison and the Fat Robin in Hamden. And you, of course, can get it online or find me at a talk. And I always have them in my car. So if you recognize me, wave me down. And, you know, I've got this great, you know, overcoat I've got. You open it up and there's bird books in the sleeves. You know. But thank you so much.
And also your the birding tours that you do, that site is...
sunrisebirding.com.
Great.
And I'll be doing walks and talks, and other people, Frank Matlick and several other people who work for Gina will be doing local walks. And Gina's got a ton of different tours worldwide, and there's some really good ones coming up. So take a look, and I hope people will join us. We had a great group in Jamaica, and I'm looking forward to Cuba, which is getting harder and harder to get to these days.
Well, thank you, and have a good spring of birding, and I hope to meet you in person sometime soon.
Yeah, I'll see you in the field.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And I've been speaking with Frank Gallo, who is the author of Birding in Connecticut, and it's a fairly recent release. You are listening to listener-supported WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM. We're online at wpkn.org.